All right, so Peter asked me to tell you about acceleration, about which I don't think I know anything. So in fact, what I'm mostly going to tell you about is things that I do think I know something about now, about certain aspects of relativistic collision with shock structure. However, I can't resist telling you a little bit about why I care. So I'll spend a few couple minutes on that before diving into endless movies of what's big league, what simulations of relativistic shocks do. So I had liked to mess with synchrotron sources, and they're all here. Even these guys, which are favorites of some around here, which are thought to be synchrotron sources, at least in part. And the question is why. One of my favorites is this business about the Crab Nebula, which I can and never fail to enjoy showing people the movie of the crab doing its thing. In here, this is the inner region of the crab. There's the pulsar. These are these whisk structures. And what you see here is something that looks for all the world like sort of a radiation zone there, and then a radiating waves go out and go out into this torus of X-ray emission out here. Many people say this inner ring here is, quote, the shock, unquote, which terminates the wind. Much of the interesting question is, what do you mean by the shock? And I'll say more about that a little bit further on. So this is one of our primary examples where we have up close and personal a relativistic outflow terminating in a relativistic shock, what we think is a relativistic shock, and which we would like to understand as sort of a poster child for the excitation of all of these different kinds of synchrotron sources.
You mean the left and the right figures?
This is Hubble optical, and that's Chandra X-ray.
And there's a line at about 45 degrees.
Yeah, it's an artifact. I should say, because the movie is full, the data are folded over, this is the result of, I didn't plan on spending a lot of time on this, but I'll say. This is the result of about 10 months of optical observations every 2 weeks. This is about 8 months of X-ray observations about every month.
So
this
with pulsar in both figures
is the pulsar is there in the optical, and there it is there in Chandra, it's burned out. There's lots of stuff in here, which is a whole separate spiel. There's what looks like a jet coming out, and if you look at the Chandra picture with the light out instead of blinding like this, you can sort of, well, particularly in the optical, you can watch this jet structure kind of boiling like a smokestack. So there's something that sends out stuff, and you can see it happening in front of you. It looks like, and when you watch this movie, you're looking at periodic phenomena. In actual fact, in my opinion, it is, but the run of data, the periodicity is probably around 6 months, and the run of data is, anybody who's ever played with periodic phenomena in astronomy, this can be real dangerous, because you think it's periodic, but really it was more of a ref noise, and it wanders off and does something else. And so there's a longer set of Chandra observations coming up, which is going to look at this for about 16 months, which will do better at establishing whether it's periodic. But the sensation you get that this inner ring here is kind of a radiation zone, which kind of jiggles and breathes and has some monkey structure, and then sends out these ray-like things that go into this outer torus, I think that's probably right. I have a model for it, so I'm credulous. There are plenty of other relativistic outflows that are of interest. This is one of the most famous black and white quasars, which spits out a arcsecond scale jets every now and again. In the jets in this program, there's lots of discussion about is this correlated with high states, low states, you name it.
General, excuse me, your microphone.
One thing that's happened, used to be if you worked on the Crab Nebula, there would be offensive observers who would say, why are you doing this? It's a special case. Nothing else is like it. And this is just to demonstrate that's not so. There's now a bit of a rogues gallery of sources like this. all of which we think do something like the same thing. That is, a relativistic outflow coming from the central object goes out, has a underluminous zone in the middle. For all the world, looks like it's colliding with the outsides and then becomes luminous, for which the natural interpretation of this is a shockwave that does the job. However, you might guarantee it's not the only interpretation. This is another favorite. I haven't actually worked much on these, but this is one of the most famous radio galaxies, central object, jet, probably relativistic, terminating in a hot spot out here, which has now shown up both in the radio and in the X-ray. And the most conventional interpretation is the radio, there's a termination of the jet here. The radio is synchrotron and the X-ray is upscattered inverse Compton radiation. But as you can see, there's a great lack of data in the middle to really deal with that question. And then once again, there are some alternatives. So if I buy the shock interpretation, the question, one question, there are many questions, but one question that people get into is, how do you convert this flow, in the case of the pulsars, almost certainly relativistic, in the case of these radio galaxies, almost certainly relativistic, and the microquasars certainly relativistic because you can see superluminal velocities. In some quasars, you see superluminal velocities also in the inner region, so it's clearly relativistic flow. Gamma ray burst modeling certainly suggests you have, from this result of explosion, a relativistic flow. Every one of these things is supposed to have a relativistic shock either terminating the flow, occurring inside the flow, which is then supposed to convert some of the flow energy into an interesting, usually in the models, power law distribution of radiating particles. And radiating particles, depending on the circumstances, usually means electrons and possibly positrons. But in some circumstances, this also means heavy ions, which then are supposed to give rise to photons eventually by pion production. And sometimes with subsequent cascades that produce then electrons and positrons. There are a variety of models of how to convert flow energy. The underlying question is, how does a shockwave in this circumstance occur? Does it occur? People believe it does, and the hydrodynamics suggest that it ought to. Does it, and how does it convert the upstream flow energy into relativistic particles? Now, within the context of shocks creating relativistic, converting flow energy to relativistic particles, there's a canonical model which has been extremely successful in the non-relativistic shock environment. And I believe at the beginning of this mini program, John Kirk and Don Ellison talked to you about that. Don, I guess, primarily about the non-relativistic stuff, and John talked some about this, looking at his slide, that this diffusive Fermi acceleration model as applied to relativistic shocks. So I'll just remind you of the basic picture. First place, it needs to be efficient, and this is an outstanding question in all of this stuff. What is the injection? How efficient? How much of the upstream flow energy is really converted into these particles by this mechanism or any other? But granted that you do inject reasonably efficiently, and there are plenty of certainly worthwhile ideas on that topic, how well does it work in the environment in question? Non-relativistically, which the typical problem is particles sliding along the field line. Has a Marmor radius already large compared to the actual formal thickness of the shock, passes through, goes downstream, scatters, turns around, comes back, goes upstream, scatters, the result is convergent flows. You get a very nice, in the test particle limit, explanation for power laws that seems very nice and universal. It's extremely appealing. And like I say, it works pretty well. And when you take the energy in the particles into account and the structure of the flow up and downstream of the shock, you even get modifications to this which appear in certain aspects of supernova remnant modeling. And there is a noticeable amount of evidence for ion acceleration by this in the interplanetary medium. There's little that I'm aware of, although I'd be happy to be corrected, of this playing a role in electron acceleration in the interplanetary medium. But when you play with this mechanism in supernova remnants, there are aspects of the synchrotron radiation that suggest the electrons are undergoing this also. So it's when you get to this in the relativistic case, the simple picture has its problems. And this point was made, in my mind, rather nicely in a paper by Beagleman and Kirk, or Kirk and Beagleman, I forget the order of the authors, a long time ago. Namely, accessibility to the upstream is very hard when the, in general, the magnetic field coming into the shock is oblique to the shock normal. The field lines are coming in faster than the particle can get upstream along them. And so it's rather difficult to send, intending the particles upstream, to have them wander around and just scatter. If they do get back, of course, they collide with this incoming magnetic field, and that really bounces them back very abruptly. Second issue is downstream, the flow is leaving rather rapidly, and in order to get the particles to come back and resample the shock, which is required to get a broad power law distribution, takes rather strong turbulence. And people are doing various test particle, very pretty, but not what I wanted. You need quite large amplitude. If you imagine the scattering downstream is done by particles doing elastic scattering off of quasi-static magnetic perturbations, the evidence I'm aware of says you need, in some sense of the word, delta B over B much bigger than 1, or delta B squared over the downstream pressure, comparable to larger than unity. So you need large amplitude turbulence to get rapid scattering. This proposal first was put out, maybe I'm just cranky, but it seemed to me that this wasn't going to work. And so I got interested in other things. I'm going to go on about this. This is not terribly important. But I do want to say that this is, in the context of these pulsar wind nebulae, there's sort of two schools of thought. One is this collection of parameters. They're very high. Sometimes gamma ray bursts have the highest Lorentz factor flows, no. Well, depends what you mean by no, but since everything's inferred from models at various levels, the highest Lorentz factors known come from these systems where gamma around 10 and 6 has been inferred in several different versions of models. And this is my version, which comes out of modeling the dynamics of these WISP structures. That is, upstream the magnetization, B squared over the upstream energy is rather small. Gamma is 10 to the 6th, the flow of pairs is, this is number comes out of a whole variety of different points of view. You need high energy ions to understand why these structures occur, and you need a flow of ions which is around this number here, which is a famous number in pulsar electrodynamics, it's the Goldberg-Julian current. And it didn't come in because we put it in by hand. And this is what's inferred by applying the model of WISP formation, which is driven by high energy ions that proceed to compress the medium as they gyrate. I'll show you the model in a moment. There's a big lacuna in all of this stuff, namely nobody has yet really understood where the radio electrons in the nebula come from. There's a large flux of radio particles that is required to understand the nebula, and there's no model I know of, at least that I respect, of production of particles by the pulsar which comes up with this type of thing. It's an outstanding question, which I will proceed to avoid. However, I will say, if you assume that this high flux of pairs comes in the same equatorial region that's feeding the torus here, then the energy conservation tells you that the expansion for velocity of the flow is quite a bit smaller, like 10 to the 4th instead of 10 to the 6th. And there are people who work on models of what's going on here that start with that assumption. My own is that the equatorial layer is very high gamma, and the dense stuff and slower stuff is at higher latitude. But that's.
Are those images one arc that I come across, by the way, at the top of the screen? Is that the full field?
That's the field here.
I see. It's on the left. And the ones on the right are the same.
This is in here. It's sort of this inner region around there. Okay. This is more the full arc minute. This is also about an arc minute, and this is the radio image, which is 5 minutes. My radio nebula is quite a bit bigger. Radio nebula is, some aspects of it are sort of have structure to it, but for example, the spectral index in the radio of the synchrotron emission is very uniform. So, I can't resist showing this, but this is the evidence that we came up with for why gamma's large. It's not modeling the whole nebula. It says, I want to understand that. It's supposed to. Come on, you were supposed to do something in time. We're not confusing. What we did is assume in the equatorial layer we have an inflow of the magnetic field and plasma, which includes high energy ions, which when they hit the shock, the initial shock that forms in the pair plasma, the high energy ions being heavier have a larger Larmor radius, so they penetrate through and start gyrating. In so doing, they launch these waves, and you get the cyclotron instability of the slow. Like to create this limit cycle on the leading edge, which acts like a radiator. Remember, the data, which is refusing to cooperate now, whereas the inner region likes to look as if you had a radiator at the inner edge. So
is the magnetic field energy density is a function of radius?
This here is the magnetic field, okay? And that is the ion momentum as a function of position for lots of particles. So they all come together at the beginning, and not surprisingly, being a cold stream and gyrating, they love to become unstable. And then they may create a heated jumble within a couple of Larmor gyrations. If you make an image, and in so doing, these things here are compressions of the magnetic field, therefore the pairs, therefore they radiate in a bunch of waves which travel out, just because you compressed up the particles, which both makes the emissivity goes up, both because the number density is up, and because in compressing the flux tube, the particle energies go up. So you get a rather strong brightening, and if you make a synthetic map out of this, you see this kind of thing, an inner antenna, if you like, which kind of sits there and breathes and can even fool you into thinking it moves backwards, and then a bunch of compressional waves that move outward in the surface brightness. And if you then fit this picture, fitting is a strong word, it's kind of a chi-by-eye type problem, to the observations here, you come up with a set of numbers that I'm quoting right here. These are consistent with the old Rees and Gunn and Kennel and Carnegie MHD models of the nebula. They're not consistent with saying that the dense flow is all here in the equator.
John, this is a standing shock?
Yeah.
And this is like a Weibull instability type?
No, it's cyclotron instability.
Cyclotron.
I have cyclotron. One of the things I hope to get across the time I'm done is that I'm talking to gamma ray burst people in particular, get this idea that things are floating around that relativistic shocks are the consequence of the Weibull instability. I mean, this is false, okay? There is a regime of parameter space where they're important, but because a gamma ray burst modeling has got people in a regime that they like to work on in which the upstream magnetic field is sufficiently weak, you don't need to think about it. But if you wanted to go do this for a AGN termination shock, you know, that might be right and it might be wildly wrong. In the PWN, I think it's not right. I have learned from that myself. I used to think that relativistic shocks are like this cyclotron instability stuff all the time. Now, in the interest of time, I would spend time on the rather beautiful stuff that's come out a little more recently on global modeling of these systems from MHD point of view, which tells you a lot about the global structure, although not very much about the composition, because MHD all it cares about is the particles and small Larmor radii. But I don't really have the time to go into that, so I would my apologies to my colleagues who do that stuff. One of them is here. I will pass over for the moment. I don't need to say more about this. So the question that this got into, originally asking about the termination shock, and then I'll show you again briefly motivation that comes from double pulsar about dealing with pair shocks, is that what is the structure of a shock wave in which you have a magnetic field, and since you're winding magnetic fields off in the central source, your zeroth order geometry is the magnetic field is transverse to the flow. Dynamical significance. In a first a E plus minus pair shock, because pulsars, we think a lot of the flow is in pairs, and except in this equatorial flow, it's probably all in pairs. And then, because we got driven to this, when we discovered something that was very annoying, and that I think is in fact right, that pair shocks don't do, only thermalize the plasma unit, they don't do any particle acceleration in the sense of non-thermal spectra at all, we got to thinking about the heavy ions, which then led to this dynamical model for the WISP structure, but the original reason was an interesting model for particle acceleration. So here's how we do it. And mostly work has been done by working with simulations. For 1D simulations, we've done things both in 1D and now in 3D. We do an upstream magnetic field, which is structured only on the flow scale, or its absence. That is, we take also looked at unmagnetized shocks. And looked at both pure electron-positron and, somebody here ought to say, electron-positron plus ion, and now a little bit of electron plus ion. We originally looked at this stuff in 1D quite a while ago, by Yves Galland's thesis, and then come back to 1D with part of Ellen Amato's thesis. There's recent work from Masahiro Shoshino has done on this, who was a participant in this study also. And there's a bunch of stuff which is related, although it's partially the way the question is formulated, is a bit different by Smolsky and Usov about plasma bounces off a magnetic barrier. The way we do this, we make a shock simulation, is start the plasma in on the left end of a simulation box, filling the box on the right wall, take it as a reflecting boundary for particles. And depending on which simulation you're talking about, either take it as far as fields are concerned, taking the wall as a conducting wall, which reflects the fields also, which turns things into standing waves, or taking it as a radiating boundary condition, so that radiation that's headed off that way is removed, so-called Lindemann boundary conditions. For the pair shocks, it's a cold neutral E plus minus, has a speed C beta. The velocity is just the ratio of the electric field to the magnetic field, so it's coming in as ideal MHD. I'm going to show you a little bit from the simulation which had the upstream magnetic energy equal to the flow energy. Upstream gamma equals 40. These are the other simulation parameters here. When anybody cares about that, I'd be happy to talk later about what's, you know, the significance in various of these things. It is very important in doing this that you resolve the microscopic length scales. With sigma equals to 1, the formal log radius upstream is equal to C over omega P length, and each of those is well resolved. Another thing that's true with this kind of calculation is you have to obey a Courant condition, so you have to keep your time step short. And it has to be less than, typically it doesn't have to be much less than the grid cell size divided by the fastest speed in the problem. If we develop other six things, that's C. Sometimes what people do in order to make the calculation run a lot faster is they make the value of C less than the truth. For us, it turns out for these kinds of things, you can scale things so that you actually don't see as one. And we've become particle physicists, but in real units, it's like this. And the results I'm going to show you are very similar if you change the upstream magnetization all the way down to 0.0005 when we got tired of it. But as you'll see, by the time you're this small, one dimension is really lying to you, missing physics. So this is a typical kind of result. This is electron momentum space, and this is a symmetric pair of plasma. The positron space is just the same, except the particles gyrate in the opposite sense. The cold plasma comes in. And after the initial thing, the big jumble, and then the shock separates from the wall and starts traveling upstream, and you have this front edge here. We do all these simulations sitting in the downstream frame. Under certain circumstances, it's possible to set it up so you sit in something like a shock frame, but with relativistic shocks, it can be a bit tricky. Because if you don't get it right, the shock will zip off your grid at the speed of light. What you see here is the momentum of the particles in units of mc in the flow direction. Actually, it's units of mc divided by, it's hard to see here, but the upstream gamma. So one is the upstream four velocity. The particles come in, they hit the magnetic field, they do the same sort of thing that I showed you in this Crab Nebula simulation. They turn into sort of a coherent gyrating loop, do another one of those, and then proceed to degrade rapidly as the cyclotron instability sets in and destroys the coherence. back reaction of the wave on the particles. In the y direction, the electric field direction, there's a rapid kind of back and forth motion. It's really what's, and then that also degrades. This one here is, actually, it looks like I have the ions in this case. Good, all right. What you have here upstream is there's a electromagnetic precursor. I'm sorry, this is just a zoom into the shock. We're looking at a much, I don't want to say this. We magnified what's happening here so you can see this particle reflection more clearly. This is upstream in the electric field. Downstream, since the flow is stationary, the electric field hangs around zero. Upstream, there's this rapid, relatively coherent fluctuation in that electric field. And because the particles have this coherent motion here, which is starting to grow kind of a gyrophase bunch structure, it radiates. So you get an upstream precursor that takes away a few percent of the energy as an electromagnetic wave that travels on at the speed of light. One of the various tests of this is you can compare all this stuff, you can go back to a uniform medium problem and ask what happens if I had a cold ring of particles in the momentum space, how do they become unstable? You can look at that in a, what happens in a uniform medium periodic simulation. For anybody who cares, I can go more about it, but this is basically the instability. And the main point is that the situation differs from non-relativistic stuff, primarily in that you can get lots of harmonics generated. Right here are the growth rates as a function of harmonic number. This is the growth rate for a cold ring running around is almost independent of harmonic number. So you can generate lots and lots of high harmonics. If you want to call it, it's a form of coherent synchrotron radiation. Now in these 1D things with pairs, what happens is everybody thermalizes downstream. What you have is here the particle data, and here's a fit of the relevant Maxwellian. There's the waves that you're generating of all these so-called upper hybrid modes happening at frequencies larger than the upper hybrid frequency. What happens is you generate them rather fast. The instability growth times are around the cyclotron time, which is short compared to the overall size of the structure. They are absorbed by a cyclotron resonant absorption, and that's fast. And so you're getting rapid emission and absorption of real photons, which is just as good as establishing local thermodynamic equilibrium as Coulomb scattering is. Nobody said that you had to create LTE by scattering off of virtual photons. You can perfectly well emit and absorb real photons, and that's the way you teach it in school. That's really what's happening. That's what's happening here. So sure enough, you get a wonderful Maxwellian. This was very depressing for the interest in high-energy particle acceleration. We kept seeing this, and I got told by various people with perfect truth, oh, well, you know, you can't see Fermi acceleration because you're only doing it in 1D. That is, if you conserve both of the transverse canonical momenta, you can't diffuse across the field line. So when you do it in 3D, it'll all be okay, you know. And then people would say that would do what I regarded as going back to sleep and kept on doing what they were doing. As you'll see, that it turns out not to be true. This is a side issue for this talk, but this EM precursor is quite interesting. And based on these 1D things, we made a simple toy estimate long ago of the brightness temperature of this thing. And it could be very high. I now know that it's not that high because we overdid the, you know, the 1D doesn't tell you what the brightness temperature is going to be because everything being completely plane parallel, the solid angle in which you're sending the radiation is zero. Therefore, the brightness temperature is formally infinite. We made an estimate of what we thought the opening angle of radiation would be, and we were rather exaggerating about it. And as you'll see in 3D, the beam is not that narrow. The spectrum is kind of interesting. As you get more and more magnetized, it gets more and more coherent. As you're less magnetized, it's a broader band. So these are all the harmonics that you excite. It leads to thoughts that relativistic shock EMP is kind of an interesting thing to play with. Now, I'm not going to say much about this, but I got into doing this again because of this system, the double pulsar. This is, of course, a cartoon. But the timing data tell you a tremendous number of things, and what they tell you, you have one 22 millisecond pulsar there in orbit around a 2.7 second pulsar there. The orbit has a 2.4 hour period, so the two objects are about a solar radius from each other. The fast one there, we think emits, it's spinning down, and we think it does that by emitting a relativistic wind, which is mostly electrons and positrons except possibly an equator. It's tipped with respect to the orbital plane, so this guy spends most of its time in wind that is electron-positron wind. And we think that the way this system works is that the wind crashes into the slow pulsar and confines the magnetosphere, and when the slow pulsar comes by and gets in front of the fast pulsar, it makes an eclipse. And I got interested not only in the overall physical phenomenon, but also trying to explain this eclipse. The obstacle here that creates an eclipse of the fast pulsar is 18,000 kilometers across, so it's not the star itself. It's only 10 kilometers, something bigger. One interesting model seemed to be you have the wind coming in, hitting the slow pulsar's magnetosphere creates a shock, and then just as the solar wind going around the Earth does, there's a magnetosheath which is heated, and maybe synchrotron absorption of that magnetosheath would make this eclipse. That turned out to be...
The shock is inside the light cylinder, or...?
I'll say in a moment, but it basically the light cylinder, the thing is too confined, but there is no light cylinder. So the way we went about doing this is more these fixed simulations, but now three-dimensional. So it's a relativistic E plus minus wind, which we use gamma as 10 to the 50, even though the 10 to the 50 of them are much bigger. But when you scale things in terms of cyclotron radii and Marmor radii, you can use any gamma you want. Again, we're using a fixed simulation. It's fully kinetic. The shocks are self-consistent. If there's reconnection that wants to occur, that's done self-consistently. Disadvantages are you have to resolve the plasma scales like Marmor radii and C over omega P lengths. Now, normally people say, oh, that must be incredibly small. And if gamma were really 50, that would be true. But one of the things you have to keep in mind here is this happened in this Crab Nebula problem. You can get into situations where the energies are so high that things like Marmor radii and C over omega P lengths are macroscopic. It's probably not the case for this system, but one says right away that this kind of thing can only do macroscopic flows by lying, that depends. When it's relativistic enough, you may not be lying. We certainly are capable of reproducing relativistic MHD behavior. We're fairly careful about that, of making sure that in regions where you ought to be seeing MHD flow, that E is really V cross the average V cross B and other such stuff. The code for anybody who's worried is a development of Oskar Blunemann's Friston code, which is three dimensions, Cartesian, it's electromagnetic, it's particle and cell. We have various ways of handling the magnetized flows. It's fully paralyzed and then is run on 128 processor machines. Typically, we're talking about, for modeling this macroscopic system, we're talking about fairly big simulations of half a billion to a billion particles. So, it used to be, when I first did these things, half a million particles was a big deal. Times have changed. But of course, the real problem is data flow. What do you do with all this stuff when you have it? So here's two snapshots of what happens with the wind coming in from the left. Field is going across here. This is just a hunk of the overall wind. We don't try to simulate the whole thing. There's a rotating dipole put there, which is just a vacuum dipole. We have not, in these calculations, tried to model wind outflow from the slow pulsar, which is energetically likely to be quite unimportant. But there are significant issues about that, which are ignored in this. When you are on the wind, the field line is like this, and the pulsar, and we took this, in this case, we took the pulsar with its rotation axis perpendicular to the plane and the magnetic axis in the plane, so it's an orthogonal rotator. When the magnetic field of the pulsar is parallel to the upstream flow. It behaves like a good diamagnetic thing. The flow goes around the obstacle, there's no reconnection. You close your line to stay closed. When you turn it around a half turn, the field lines are now available for rapid reconnection, and rapid reconnection occurs. So this at this point, the question about resolving the plasma scales becomes important. The C over omega P lambda here is large, so this isn't a surprise. So if you like, this simulation is done in such a way that the hypothesis of rapid reconnection is assumed to be true. That is, reconnection happens quickly on the compared to the dynamical time scale.
Do you get any particle acceleration with reconnection?
We don't see any, okay? And I should make a side comment. People often talk about reconnection being a big particle accelerator, but under most circumstances in reconnection, most of the plasma never gets near a place where the electric field can act as an accelerator. Throughout most of this volume, the electric field applies E cross B drift,
flow,
okay? Now, when you actually do reconnection in sort of an X-point-like structure, there's a separatrix running along in here. There's some particles that go through there, and they will accelerate. But we don't, you know, if it does anything to the distribution function, it's basically lost in half billion particles. We haven't found the right particles in the output to really tell us.
Do you put in things like anomalous diffusion?
No, nothing like that is put in. This is what happens here is that you get. I mean, the reason that happens is because on the plasma skin depth scales, the particles are no longer frozen to the field lines. And so the electric fields are moving them across the magnetic field and allowing the field lines to reconnect. But there's nothing was put in terms of by hand turbulence. Well, there are particles in there, and they certainly are going to get accelerated, but there's nothing dramatic in terms of what happens to the distribution function. Okay.
So I'm trying to understand this comment. You're saying it's a small fraction of the magnetic energy dissipates, or?
No, reconnection, if you take MHD reconnection seriously, okay, so the X point and the region of diffusion occupies a set of measure zero. All that happens is you're getting topological reorganization of the magnetic field and release of lots of magnetic energy into flow. Okay. You could, of course, take those flows that come out of here. There's flow, you know, we're getting here, flow comes like that and goes through here, something goes right through here and gets squirted out sideways. And say it collides with something else, and then say there was shock acceleration, use that magnetic acceleration to do that. That's the MHD picture. When you start resolving this stuff, Mayabarsky gave a sort of simulation of his driven reconnection sheets where the plasma that was in the sheet was getting, you know, plenty hot, and stuff that's in there is gains a lot of energy from that electric field. In his problem, essentially all the plasma in what you imagine, you know, when you set that into the context of the flow model he's considering, all the plasma has to do that. But it's something like this, where you're brushing by and only a rather small region is where you're breaking MHD, then not much of the plasma is exposed to that. That's a generic problem with reconnection.
Energetically, I think even if at large distances, this flow is, you are getting an energy conversion to flow, is that significant to me in the energy budget and the amount of energy?
Most of it is in flow when it comes in and stays in flow. The shock deflects most of it to flowing around the magnetosphere. The shock is the dominant dynamical feature here. Reconnection in some sense is a red herring, but it's important to the torque on this object. So it's like, stop that. By connecting field lines like this, you're going to drag on the star, and because the star is rotating, that creates the torque that dominates the spin down. So the magnetic field is quoted for this slow pulsar. This is a movie of the same thing, so you get to see things changing its mind, you see the flow going off downstream, the whole thing likes to shake and vibrate. It's doubly periodic, which we thought was really important. And I'm not going to go into the phenomenology of this, because the model of the eclipse is now much better, something is happening inside the magnetosphere, all the flow dynamics is important. This is about the torque on the object, unless somebody cares, I'm going to skip it over. And there are lots of wonderful phenomenology. But the questions we got involved with shocks had to do with through most of the orbit of this system, since the fast pulsar is tilted, with respect to the orbital plane, the slow pulsar mostly lives in high latitude wind. Okay? Which I think is really important, because what we know about these relativistic outflows by looking at the pulsar wind nebulae, what we're seeing is the equatorial wind. And Sergei's and Delzana's models for the formation of the jet say that all the action came by energy injected in the equator and then flowed back. And that, you know, works really nice. So if you want to learn about what's happening here, you have to pay attention to what's happening to high latitude wind, which we don't know anything about, and here we have a possible probe to that. So that's, to me, was one of the attractions of doing this. So we got involved in asking about the shock here. There are reasons having to do with the formation of eclipses, and the system shows unpulsed emission, which might be due to emission from the shock plasma. So that meant me looking harder at what shocks are doing, and these days we've been able to do 3D shocks, and for the all the people who are convinced that Fermi acceleration is the way things happen in all shocks, relativistic or not, all the complaints that things weren't 3D before is now it's 3D, and so none of the canonical momenta are conserved, and if there's going to be transverse diffusion and scattering, it'll happen. Typical scale of these simulations is like this. Unless somebody wants me to spend more time on this, I'm just going to move on, but anybody who wants to know more about how these calculations are done, I'm happy to say more. Yes, right now. So one thing we did now, instead of being prejudiced by we're dealing with a magnetized system, is my collaborator is much more efficient than me, and he has gone, he's gone and we've sampled a whole lot of parameter space. So this is a sigma equals zero shock. And the question is there such a thing as a unmagnetized collisionless shock? Such a thing has never been observed experimentally. So we see in the solar system are shocks where the dynamics is clearly dependent on the presence of a large-scale magnetic field. And so this idea that you can make a shock out of nothing but Weibull instability was presented in public. It's something Ferd Carnini and I worked on 20 years ago, but never really convinced ourselves we had conclusions we wanted to publish. For non-relativistic shocks, now Avi Loeb and Medvedev came up with the idea for the GRB context. And in terms of making a shock, it works just dandy. So this is not a movie yet. But this is just a little picture of Weibull instability. People tried this many years ago for electrostatic instabilities. And electron ion shock and electrostatic instability doesn't work because you have two colliding plasmas, the electrons immediately heat through electron-electron two-strain instability, and the hot mobile electrons short out the ion bunches that try to form via ion two-strain instability. And the turbulence level is very low. So people concluded you couldn't make a shock, although if you actually read the papers, you realize they were assuming a shock meant something had to form on the Debye-Lent scale. In fact, you look at the turbulence level that was found in some of the early simulations. If you want to think as an astrophysicist, there's weak scattering. It'll go, it'll be very broad and diffusive, but eventually it might well form a shock. And that's, in fact, what the Weibull instability is more effective, certainly for the relativistic case. And the way it works is illustrated right here. You get current filaments forming with a perturbed magnetic field, and the sense of the forces is to enhance the current filaments. This is, actually, I don't want to go into this. This comes from work that the UCLA group did.
John, when you say unmagnetized, do you mean that you started with no magnetic field?
That's right.
At all?
Well, there's noise.
There's noise, okay.
Well, the solar simulations have
noise.
So there's initially, there's little delta Bs all over the place on sort of the grid scale. But we let it grow out of that.
You just described why the two-stream instability is ineffective for an electron-ion plasma.
Right.
But here you're dealing with a parent plasma.
Yes, I also deal with electron-ion plasma a bit. Same is true.
But the two-stream instability can be more effective for a pair plasma.
You can make a, start off with a pure pair plasma, you can do fine. It just by the time, and now the practical consequence, anytime you're doing it with a pair plasma, you're using the relativistic system. And so the electromagnetic effects are, you can't make an electrostatic instability unless you make it strict in a relativistic system, unless you make it strictly one-dimensional, which is quite unrealistic. People often talk about two-stream instabilities electrostatically. Pulsar literature is replete with this. And I always think it's quite unrealistic, because the moment I have any sort of gradient around, I'll get, if I take a charge and move it along, get a charge and move it along at C, I'll get a vector potential that's just as big, and so it's intrinsically electromagnetic. Unless you're very careful to make all the perpendicular wavelengths exactly the infinity is. So here's the density in one of these structures, and you can see it growing up. Weibull instability is going on here and the leading edge, and you get a long stringy structure. They're forming these filaments that are famous for this, that form in the shock edge and then eventually builds up and you get the denser plasma down here.
So now this is electron positron?
This is electron positron. You're going to see a lot of electron positron for a while, because I think we get around to writing a paper about this, it'll either be one massive paper or a number of smaller ones. We can say things that are reasonably definitive about electron-positron shocks. So we took the time to figure it out, although the answers are, for particle acceleration purposes, a little disappointing. This thing down here is the evolution of the density. And the other one is the velocity. So the density is, basically upstream, then it builds up, it's kind of a long ramp there, it's like 20 or 30 C over omega P thick, to build up to the downstream conditions. And the velocity drops similarly, rather slowly. So on plasma physicists' numbers, this is a thick structure. Now, I'm not personally all that familiar with the GRB numbers, but for GRB folks who like this type of thing, 20 or 30 C over omega P is still a small scale relative to the overall structure that people have in mind. I can tell you this, interesting pulsar type applications where one could say 20 or 30 C over omega P would be macroscopic, but that's a different story. I put this up in loyalty to my collaborator, who is fascinated with this phenomenon, but I think it's not something that's really associated with physics. You can see here in the density distribution, there's a bunch of particles zipping along upstream from where the shock front is. This is a consequence of the initial conditions, and part of this in thinking about how you got diffusive Fermi going, you'd like to have some upstream turbulence in the classical model. The only place we get anything like that is when you set this up by bouncing off the back wall as a bunch of particles zipping along upstream. So you think it's like if you had colliding shells in a GRB, these are particles that are in the initial collision of the shell, and then some of them zip up upstream ahead of it. So in the initial conditions, there's some particles upstream which are exciting these current filaments up there. I myself think this is, if you think about the physics of any real situation, this is an artifact that's not going to be very interesting for continued acceleration. But we aren't fairly clear about how to exclude that, so I show that
But it is exciting the current filaments well ahead of the shock.
It gets them going. Okay, so then
it could be making the shock broader than it otherwise would like.
Right, I mean, I take seriously the structure that's down in here. Okay, you get current filaments forming, growing up and doing it. That's all something that I think is, if you wait long enough and take these guys out of the system, but had this still propagating, you would still see the shock continuing. But, you're going to ask questions about how you initially, what triggered the whole thing in the first place. Okay. And I personally leave that question a bit open. But this is a good example of something that's seriously the shock structure. Here's all these filaments forming, and then the plasma gets heated. So this is density structure. This is magnetic field structure. Lots of current of filaments, of filamentary magnetic fields here, and then they merge and get turned into bigger structures down here. And the movie I'm going to show you, what it's represented here is, take this picture here, take a slice through it, and then move it through. And what you're going to see is watching the magnetic field structure start as small little things and become ever bigger and bigger as the current filaments like to merge together. This has been a subject that has interested people quite a bit, because there's the hope that you can get a mean magnetic field of magnitude of interest to radiation physics for the GRB. So here you can see what happens as things go on the field structures get bigger and bigger until you get to the end back here. And in order to do these simulations, they're quite long. They're about 800 or in some, a couple of cases, 1,500 cells long. You see over a megapee length, it's 15 cells. So there's a lot of, for this kind of thing, a lot of dynamics in there.
Nothing like transverse literature.
Transverse is, these are 400 across. And, yes. So they're pretty big. But the end result, in everything we can see, is that the scale of structure you get to eventually is controlled by the size of the system you're looking at. Now, if you make it big enough, though, you might draw the conclusion that where things are headed, this is magnetic energy down here as a function of position, or flow time, if you like. The time they get to the back, the magnetic energy is, in terms of the kinetic energy, is really tiny. You know, it's well less than 1%. And as long as we're able to do this, the magnetic energy is still dying away. And slowly, like an inverse power law of time, like T minus 0.7 or so. But it hasn't saturated. And there are people in literature who have claimed that it does saturate. Ones that claim saturation are basically working in periodic boundary conditions, but I think in the end they're fooled by the periodicity of the system. Well, that's the spatial structure, but the amplitude, this is all the way back at the amplitude, is very small. The scale is large, but the amplitude is small.
But this may be related to this, to limiting the size of the transverse.
The fact it's dying out, or the fact it doesn't die out? Which way?
Both.
But my opinion is, this question is not going to get an answer out of PIC simulation. For these kinds of reasons, you're down at a tiny fraction of the energy. This is a lousy technique to deal with small parameters. What's happening because of this inverse cascading of what's going on is it's feeling the boundaries all the time. Now, this is a whole set of statements which means the problem is accessible to certain kinds of what you might call mode coupling theory. I'm not sure I'm going to work on that, but I know Gennady Schvetz in Texas is rather interested in messing with this, and I suspect that you guys have said you're kind of interested. So my bet is that it'll do, and these kind of simulations are a good check on such theories. So, march onwards. So this is more about magnetic field generation. Here you get to see, you can see here in the course of time it gets bigger and bigger. I think it could stop at maybe 40. Yeah!
Like that.
Sean, can you finish in about 10 minutes? Yeah, I'll try. I'm going to zip on quickly then. Now the unmagnetized pair shock, this is kind of the phase-safe structure, the flow momentum versus position, and the other two coordinates, which are quite similar. Here is the particle spectrum, which I don't know what you can see, but the end result is it fills out rapidly, and by the time you get to the end, it's a wonderful Maxwellian. This is particle number, the distribution function, basically a log of that versus the energy. So out to 4 or 5 kT, we have a Maxwellian.
What those mean to make us think of the power law?
I had to tell you what I didn't give you a chance to say, what are the axes? Log F versus E, not log F versus log E. Too bad.
That's why you're a bad reputation. Playing this trick sometimes.
I don't play you a trick. I just don't tell you the answer you wanted to hear. Magnetized perpendicular shocks. I'll do this quickly. This is like the one-dimensional stuff we did before. This is density structure. And that's in the plane of flow and magnetic field. The other one is in the plane of flow and of electric field. There's flow toward Peter, B is like this, and E likes to be like that, as far as energy is concerned. This is all density right here. And I'll show you a picture right here, a snapshot, so you get them next to each other. So there's the two planes. And you can see in the plane of Long Beach, stuff likes to filament up a lot, and they're kind of long and stringy. So So for this reason, the EM precursor is not just a nice plane wave coming out, and out of this one can extract rather interesting kinds of brightness temperature information. Well, that's a different.
It also seems different, and here you have these parallel planes of high density propagating back.
Yeah, it keeps a lot of coherence. So this is the magnetic energy is 10% of the upstream energy, flow energy. And then knows how to keep coherence a long time. And if you actually look at the distribution functions, it keeps general phase coherence quite a bit. So the whole thing is quite interesting. As you push the magnetic field up, you see more and more of that. Coherent structure is much more preserved than in the low signal phase. This is 3D phase space. Let me just, you've seen this sort of thing before. I want to point to this is density, so right where the particles are reversing the density, everything comes to a halt, so density goes way up. The electric field is there, flow velocity is there, and somebody else is around here somewhere. I forgot the reason I'm going to get red is the magnetic field. I'm colorblind, I can't see the red. Somebody can see the red. I hope you're happy. So there's electromagnetic. Let's skip along about that. Something that's very interesting and shows up actually in some interpretations, some of the synchronous or at least in possibility, is plasma likes to be, doesn't isotropize. This is the momentum and isotropy, and this is plotting particles as a function of momentum in the flow direction versus transverse momentum, and you can see the kind of the thing that kind of heaped up in the plane of flow and perpendicular to B. B is running across like that. So initially it's very anisotropic. Everybody's coming in all gyrating right across the magnetic field, but it preserves that as far as one can see. Many hundreds of Larmor radii.
So it gets one temperature, but it's anisotropic, or it has two temperatures?
It has really two, it's a two temp, it's a anisotropic, there's a perpendicular and a parallel temperature. So this spread right here is a parallel temperature.
So why aren't particle instabilities driven? Why aren't instabilities driven to us?
They are.
It is ion cyclotron.
Well, the ion cyclotron is what sets it up, but actually would like to get isotropized is temperature anisotropy Weibull instability. We wrote a couple papers about that based on the earlier stuff some years ago. It takes a long time for the Weibull instability to fully isotropize it.
So what fraction of the kinetic energy was actually, if you still have a very large anisotropy at the end of the simulation?
It's about 2-1 anisotropy.
2-1. Yeah. So most of it is gone.
Oh, well, this kind of anisotropy is long gone. The 2-1 anisotropy is quite interesting for things like interpreting the morphology of the things like the X-ray torus or the Chandra ring or that sort of thing. But in terms of doing basic, more elementary astrophysical modeling, that type of anisotropy is not terribly significant. I mean, you want to take it isotropic, you can do so.
Changes some of the equation of state.
Yeah. Right. No, the equation of state here is kind of a mix somewhere between gamma equals 4 whereas in gamma equals 3 half. So here we're going down to much lower sigma and it starts looking like a Weibull instability. So we go all the way down. By this time, the sigma is 0.03, it's as if the mean magnetic field weren't there. The end results is entirely dominated by what the Weibull instability is. And the reason for that is that the Weibull instability likes to saturate at about delta B squared is about 1% of the flow energy. And so once you make the mean magnetic field weaker than that, then the charged particle dynamics cares about the fluctuating field more than it cares about the mean field. And another way of saying that is the Weibull instability has a growth rate that's sort of comparable to the plasma frequency, while the cyclotron instability has a growth rate comparable to the cyclotron frequency. And if you make it that weak, then the plasma frequency growth is faster. So here's my conclusions for perpendicular pair shocks. This is kind of the dividing line between meeting magnetic dynamics and plasma dynamics. A couple of years ago, Masahiro Hoshino suggested even in very low sigma, you might get an interesting particle accelerator based on shock drift, that is a plane parallel shock front. If you have a big overshoot in the magnetic field, you can trap particles near the front, and then it'll drift all across the front parallel to the electric field. And to get an interesting effect, you've got to trap them in the front for a long time. And so he said, well, I can do that. And he got this interesting example with very low sigma. He got a strong non-thermal tail. We don't see any signs of that for the obvious reason that the shock isn't, sort of the front is not nice and plain parallel like that. And you can't trap the particles so nicely. So my opinion is, nice try. But
so you're saying those were 1D results?
Yes. So,
but still a potential drop across, right?
In these pair shocks, there's no electrostatic potential. So you can't play Sogdaev's game of having a trap particles electrostatically. And when we do it with the heavy ions, we also don't see that strong electrostatic potential. That's an important effect for non-relativistic shocks, but it doesn't seem to be important for relativistic. The magnetic reflection and trapping is more important.
Do you have results also for electron proton?
Yes, I'm coming to that. So I will not say, when you do it obliquely, what you get is the unsurprising result that if it's oblique enough, we're given, if its sigma is high enough to demagnetize, and it's oblique enough, then it looks like a transverse shock. And if you make it almost close enough to parallel, it looks like a Weibull-dominated shock. And the crucial thing is, you just said I evaluated sigma based on the perpendicular component of the magnetic field and not the total field. Then you could use the numbers I gave you about where to make the transition. In the interest of time, I'm not going to compare to previous other people's work on these Weibull-like things, but I'll be happy to talk about it if somebody wants. So if you put in heavy ions, you get interesting dynamics that show more signs of particle acceleration. And this is an example from the 1D stuff that we both did and are doing on the heavy ions plus pairs, where you get a parallel distribution of these cyclotron waves. There's the cyclotron frequency is lingering around there. And you get this electromagnetic fluctuations, which have a broad parallel spectrum. Resonant reabsorption of that likes to create non-thermal distribution functions in the pairs, not in the ions. The ions look like trying to thermalize, and if anything, they're kind of truncated at high energy, because they've given up energy to the waves. But if you make the ion density large enough, you get a non-thermal tail to what's going on. And this is done for mass ratios 100, while the old stuff we did some years ago was much lower. So I'm pretty confident that this is right as far as 1D is not lying. If you make the ions high but not too high, electrons and positrons accelerate about equally because the waves are pretty close to linearly polarized, equal amounts of left and right circular. You make the ions very high, then it goes all into positrons. And this type of cyclotron resonance effect, if it kept going, would tend to go away when you get to just electrons and protons. Photons are still happily thermalizing, and that's going to keep on happening.
This is also not good for the GLDs, because the electrons only get to the thermal proton energy, and we need them to go.
Yeah, you can
to go well about it.
You can go a little further if you get subharmonic resonance with still lower frequency turbulence, but there's not much signs of that, much of that showing up.
We need to get them way above
that. All I am is just facts, man.
facts in this particular simulation.
Yes, correct. Well, those are the facts as we have them.
We also have the facts from the observations.
There's another approach that, one of my conclusions is that I'm going to get to, if I can pre in advance, that there's no evidence here for diffusive Fermi, yet diffusive Fermi in the test particle limits a nice model. Okay? And you can have. So here's electron ion shocks in 3D. So electrons are more, in order to do this at all, you have to do now low mass ratios, which I don't like. My experience has been that mass ratios are 15 and 20. There's a lot you don't learn. You're not really lied to, but there's a lot of things you don't find out. And you can see here, there's the ion ring forming. The electrons do the same sort of stuff much more quickly. This is the flow phase momentum as a function of position in the two species. Electron energy gets very high in the regions where the ions have this reflection thing. It's basically because the electrons get very compressed in that region. And they're stuck to field lines, so they gain a lot of energy.
I don't understand all the details, but by necessity, there's no way to measure turbulence in these simulations. I don't know. can scale close volume to the ion side turbulence.
Well, it makes it, the turbulence goes with it.
But on larger than scales. There's no cascading to larger than scales.
There's no signs of that, okay? But I don't think I want to go very far to say that there can't be any signs of it.
And there could be injection.
Of what?
And what changes in the accretion error in the outflow rate?
This is, you know, what we want to know is what the shock did. You could always, and many times this happens if people have been playing with long turbulence that is either resonant with high energy ions or long wavelength with respect to the Marmor radio ion, saying the upstream medium has non-thermal levels of turbulence in it. And if you say the astrophysical environment has that either because you know it or because you want it to be there so as to get the result you want, I am not going to argue in this context. If I ask this, the physics of the shock structure itself to do that, there's no sign that it wants it. In particular, we have had repeatedly in both sigma equals zero and sigma large, no signs that particles trying to get upstream excite lots of upstream turbulence in the manner that is always made use of in non-relativistic diffusive Fermi models. So if you wish to believe that happens, I obviously can't stop you, but I can't give you any evidence from a more a priori physics point of view that such a thing occurs.
John, maybe we should wrap up then.
Yes, so let me finish
the discussion this afternoon.
Finish off here. This is an unmagnetized electron ion shock, and this is the last thing I will present on the shock stuff. This is real hard to do, because with the magnetic field around, the magnetic localization helps you a lot. This is a very large simulation, and you can see here in the ion phase space using incoming ion stream, stuff bounced off the wall, and we've almost gotten back up the stream with 3,000 cells. Okay, and remember the C over omega P length was 15, so this is a big simulation. And by the time I'm getting back up here, the ions have failed to come to a stop. What they've done is the effect of the ion Weibull instability has been to localize them into channels. So the ion density looks like this. The ions are here, separated from each other, and each of these channels is where the electrons like to sit. Okay. The fact the electron currents are sitting here really cuts down the merger of the ion filaments. So it takes this thing, I don't know how long, to decide that it wants to turn into something that you would call a shockwave. What we have is a bunch of ion beams.
Is our order unity fluctuations in density? Or
yes.
What is the scale?
There's basically no ions in here.
Like 0 to 1.
Yes. And this is the magnetic structure that goes with that, of the field lines wrapping around these channels. God, you can't see that at all. There is a spectrum here. No, that's not what I wanted to do. That wasn't a movie. I couldn't even tell. This is, again, log F versus E, not log F versus log E. So what's here is there is a peak coming up here, and this is the basic Maxwellian, and then starting here, it flattens off and forms, at least as far as this goes, a hotter Maxwellian.
You're on the right track.
Right.
You have darker lines, you can see it so
much. Yes. Well, look fine. I only say this because you'll find in the literature last fall a paper by Aki Nordlund's group, Hedendahl and company, saying it's called acceleration by non-Fermi mechanism in the shock. And they see the same business in the structure, same issue, that the ion channels are going on. They're nowhere near having stopped. Same sort of mass ratio. Then they present a shorter segment of this and say it's a power walk. Now, so out to about 5 kT, we have a hot ion, hot electron component. Okay, there's no sort of hot ions around. So those who want cosmic rays out of this there's no evidence here that it's happening. And I am unable at the present time to decide whether this thing will eventually evolve into power, more power-like distribution or not. I have a long way to go, and I have to say that at the current level of technology, it's not easy to get a hell of a lot further with this. So if you ask me where to go from here, I have thoughts, but I don't have any really obvious suggestions other than we can keep doing exactly what Ellie is pointing to, saying, well, keep on modeling the data with plausible hypotheses and assuming that the underlying physics will cooperate, even though at the present time, there's no particular evidence I know of that the underlying physics, if you can understand, is a theoretical problem, does want to cooperate. What can one say? It happens often. And I can't resist stopping and saying what I'm personally interested in accelerating UAGs, which I wrote on some years ago, which instead of any of this stuff and shocks is sort of advanced accelerator physics. That is, take a rapidly rotating electromagnetic object, have it spin off its wind, which likes to form in the equator, this kind of Sergei Bogoralov has these beautiful little, some people call it toy model, I think it's probably got the essence of what's going on, of a frozen and wiggling current sheet. This is a simulation we did in E plus minus in 2D a while ago, which shows the same sort of phenomenon when you slice it through the equator. My pet picture is this business about having sheets in the wind liking to destroy themselves, which there's two classes of models, one which has been published on a lot, that reconnection or inductive heating gets rid of this wave-like component, but it takes a very long time to do it. The reconnection processes don't seem to be very fast. Another idea, which I kind of like, is that this thing likes to convert to a superluminal strong wave, so it's back, if you like, it's all the way back to some an MHD, if you like, variation of Gunn-Ostreicher acceleration, and the thing likes to propagate off, and particles are picked up and accelerated to very high energy that way. And I wrote a long and noisy paper a few years ago about applying that sort of linear accelerator idea to making UAGs, which, you know, since we're supposed to be talking about UAGs, I'll show you the theoretical spectrum I cooked up, which can be arranged and look somewhat like the high-energy data, although particularly around here it is, yeah, it's sort of not very comfortable. So this was Magotar. Young, rapidly rotating and irritating Magotar winds in normal galaxies. So just like GRBs, it says, go get things popping off within GZK volume and sending particles to us every now and then. Energetics are very similar to the GRB kind of model. And after that, you know, I think the physics of actually accelerating UHEs by any of these things is largely speculative. So I personally enjoy chasing after this kind of thing, but you know, I do think it's a rather important piece of physics for the pulsar wind problem, which is why I'm interested.
Okay, well,
on
that point, maybe we should thank you.
Now you know what I know.
There are questions.
Is there any prospect of getting a simulation which follows the shock? I mean, if you think of the non-relativistic case, it's a kind of thought to be a kind of bootstrap mechanism. You know, there's Bell's instability, which makes a strong field upstream, and that's driven by the energy of the particles.
It could
be that it takes a long time to get into this state, and your shock just leaves the system after 100 skin dips.
Yeah, I alluded to that, but it's possible to run a shock where you try to set up the shock in the box and it stays put. So you have flow coming in, passes through the shock, and you watch this whole structure evolve. The question of whether you could see stuff that got upstream and did think about what Bell wants to talk about, which is a non-relativistic problem.
You might be different in the relativistic.
Well, one's optimism or pessimism is until the act is done is going to differ. I am pessimistic that you're going to see much activity of particles. Lots of particles zipping upstream, creating lots of turbulence up there in the relativistic case. I see no evidence that it even wanted to try happening, never mind that I couldn't follow it. The answer to that is, in some sense, yes, but I'm not quite sure what you mean by saying I put the shock in and then I keep moving the grid so as to follow it. I want to put the shock in and have it stay placed on the grid.
Well, the problem,
and then you have to.
My idea is that your shock's gone before anything.
That's the way you set it up here. The way you set it up here. at low sigma, there's nothing against setting one up such that you, well, the way you do this is you start the problem off. Suppose I have my box filled with particles, and in the middle, upstream, I have cold particles, downstream, I have hot particles, where hot means according to the jump conditions, and I have a jump. And then I watch this evolve. And that type of simulation has been used quite successfully for non-relativistic interplanetary shocks. We originally tried that for a high sigma shock. And it was real hard to do because if the shock wants to move, it wants to move at the speed of light. And it's very hard to set up a big enough system that it really wants to settle down and stay stationary. At low sigma, it can be done. It's just we were very interested in getting a feel for what was happening here, and this bounce off the wall type initial conditions is very convenient and quick to do that type of thing. Last I talked to Anatoly about it, he was actually trying one of these things, setting up the shock, electron ion shock, the thing sitting in the middle, and see if we get it to stay put and see what happens. Then to answer your question about whether you have enough space in order to see what happens depends on how big you can make it. If you think you have to wait a certain number of Larmor radii for particles getting upstream to do something interesting, you'd better be able to resolve that. And however you do the simulation, moving window or whatever, you have to do it.
In your papers in the early 90s, I thought you had these graphs where you put in 5 or 10% protons and you showed non-thermal positrons.
Yes, yes. I showed you one of those.
And I guess I wondered, well.
Now it shows electrons too, if you make the mass ratio high enough.
Okay. I wondered how the fraction of protons depends on the mass ratio assumed in the simulation of the protons versus the electrons. So I think it was 20 in first calculation.
Yeah, now we've got them in the 1D stuff with 100. And the issue that shows up there, what you get, depends. There's an initial condition, there's an upstream condition one's assuming. That is, this is a traditional shock picture. The upstream flow is unstructured, charge neutral, not carrying current. Okay? That means if you compose your upstream medium out of electrons, positrons, and heavy ions, okay, the more I make of heavy ions, the less I have of positrons. So the pair plasma becomes non-symmetric. Now, if you keep your mass ratio low, and then the second thing is that you see these effects of the ions are important when the ions have a fair fraction of the energy density. So everybody's coming with the same speed, and therefore the mass ratio determines, if you hold the energy density fixed, what the number densities have to be. So you make your mass ratio low and you want a big energy density, you have to have a lot of ions, which upsets the symmetry of the pair plasma. This is why in those old things we saw only positron acceleration, because waves in the pairs, which by generically want to be linearly polarized, equal amounts of left and right circular, instead were quite right circular and proceeded to interact primarily with positrons. Now we put the mass ratio up, we get things where if you don't make the ion number density too large, we're getting fairly symmetric acceleration.
I think we should break for lunch. Mm-hmm.